You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, September 15th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Nicole Nguyen, Associate Professor of Social Foundations at the University of Illinois, Chicago, on Curriculum of Fear, Homeland Security, and U.S. Public Schools. Also on the program today, Wells Fargo, in the wake of paying a massive fine for cheating customers and non-customers, blame the employees they've already fired for creating a culture, for creating a fraudulent culture at the bank. Fortunately, they're already gone, so nothing to see here. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren has a question for the newly chatty FBI director. Remember how you explained to us why you didn't prosecute or charge Hillary Clinton? How about doing that for why you didn't charge the banksters? Report out of Britain. David Cameron screwed Libya and aided ISIS. And this is exciting. Peter Thiel could be our next Supreme Court justice.
Get ready!
Yeah.
It's going to be fabulous. Oh my God, these robes are gross.
I don't like the way that you wrote about my decision. Guess what I'm going to do? Buy your newspaper, or just shut it down.
Can Supreme Court justices, like, send tanks in? Just, like, gross websites?
I didn't like the picture of me that you took on your website. The internet is over. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, that Peter Thiel thing, that's very possible. Very possibly could be our next Supreme Court justice. I mean, this is apparently that's what he's telling. Peter Thiel is telling his friends that Donald Trump has promised him that he will be his first Supreme Court nominee. And it's not very hard, frankly, to believe that. I mean, it is, I mean, you know, I don't, Donald Trump is a pathological liar, but Peter Thiel, he's a billionaire. I mean, Trump might lie to everybody else, but to a billionaire, I wonder how much money Peter Thiel gave him in his campaign to get that type of. I'm just curious. I mean, I would imagine there's some support there.
Anyways. I'm at a crossroads here, Peter, because you have a lot of money. You've said very nice things about me, but I'm also really committed to lying to people. So you got to let me reflect on that.
Donald Trump was in Flint, Michigan. And for Ring of Fire, I'll be interviewing the Flint, Michigan mayor about his visit. But Donald Trump was in Flint, Michigan, grandstanding about. You'll recall that when all this stuff was really going down, he said, "I'm not going to comment on that." He did show up in Michigan yesterday, and then got chastised by a pastor for trying to exploit them. We will play that sound later in the program. A lot of people freaking out about this election. I mean, we're trying to do a little bit of counter programming here, at least for the first half of the program. And this is an interesting story of a researcher at a high school around in Maryland that is basically has a Homeland Security curriculum. But a lot of people are freaking out about the election. Like, literally, the only communication I get now from the outside world, I think I mentioned this yesterday, is, have I seen this poll? Have I seen that poll? Is this for real? Is that for real? And all I can tell you is that, you know, the polling, I think, is probably more or less accurate, but it's going to change. It's just a snapshot. And really, it is going to put a tremendous amount of pressure on the debates. I think the debates are going to be vitally important. The other thing that is important is going to be, what does a campaign do when they have such a small apparatus to mobilize a vote? And there are, there are examples of this in the past. I mean, having a field operation is less relevant for Republicans than it is for Democrats, because Republicans tend to vote more consistently. We see that in off-year elections. But so it remains to be seen. And I also think that, we still have 2 months. I could tell you that I've looked into the polls and seen some anomalies that, really at the end of the day, you can't tell. I mean, the Ohio poll that came out the other day has a breakdown that looks more like the 2004 electorate than it does the 2012 electorate, at least if you compare it to the exit polls. But we don't know what the 2012 was a very different year than 2016 is going to be. The only thing I can tell you is that they're making less white people. They're making less old white people and making more younger non-white people. And I think you can just look around and generally understand that older white people are not necessarily going to be the key demographic for Hillary Clinton. And younger non-white people are not necessarily flocking to Donald Trump. So I don't think Jill Stein is much of a factor at this point. I think Gary Johnson is getting, in some places, getting bigger numbers. But we'll see. I mean, certainly it seems that Clinton does better in a two-way race than she does in a four-way race. And my understanding is that the Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, is going to be on in every ballot in the country. And Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, will be on probably 4/5 of the ballots. But like I say, I haven't seen any polling that shows Jill Stein getting more than 3 or 4% tops. I've seen some with Gary Johnson getting up 12-13%. The real question is, will he start to hit a threshold that will get him into the debates? And I think that would be very problematic for Hillary Clinton, because Gary Johnson does not seem to be espousing anything other than he's like a Republican, just not Donald Trump. And,
okay, got it.
Yeah. I mean, right.
That was, oh, Aleppo.
What is Aleppo?
Oh, okay. Got it. I would privatize the children there.
That whole Aleppo thing, I think it got a lot less attention than it probably should have. But one of the reasons why it got such a little amount of attention is I think that people don't want to give attention to Gary Johnson. But that's pretty stunning. For a guy whose platform, to the extent that there's anything that he shows about what libertarianism is, right? It's his position on drugs and this idea that they shouldn't intervene. But, and it's not that he shouldn't intervene. I mean, we know that in 2012 he said, I'd leave drones on the table. Definitely.
Drones. So, oh, okay.
Yeah. What are drones? And drones are? But the point is that if you're going to say you're not going to intervene in a place, you should at the very least have taken the time to be aware of that place. And it's not like Aleppo is, you know, some sort of obscure situation. Aleppo is at the heart of perhaps the most problematic conflict that exists right now in the world.
Got it. Got it.
Right. And that's in the papers?
Can you say that there's a news report about this somewhere?
All right. But I just got off on a tangent. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nicole Nguyen. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Nicole Nguyen. She is an assistant professor of social foundations at the University of Illinois Chicago, author of Curriculum of Fear, Homeland Security in U.S. Public Schools. Welcome to the program, Nicole.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So let's start with this. You spent a year at a school that you call Milton High in the Maryland area. How did you come about this? No, because it never even occurred to me that something like this existed. Frankly, I'm curious as how you came to find this school and. What was the catalyst for your doing this study?
So like you, I had actually never heard of a Homeland Security program housed in a high school either. And I actually just came across the school by chance. I was Googling something. I was procrastinating Googling. And I came across a different high school that had also had a Homeland Security program. And I'm somebody who's been involved in public school reform. I study the militarization and securitization of the United States. and really had no idea that this kind of these kinds of educational arrangements were happening, were occurring. And so even though my research was about something else, I really thought, you know, I really need to know more about what's going on at these schools. And so I reached out to Milton High School, and it was really just this curiosity of, I've never heard of the Homeland Security Program before. What's going on in the Homeland Security Program? How is it shaping how young people are thinking about and making sense of the world through this new national security lens? And so for me, it was really a curiosity about, you know, what a Homeland Security education entails and what it means and says about the direction of this nation.
Well, I mean, give us a sense of where this program at Milton fits in with the rest of the educational system. I mean, this isn't terribly widespread, is it? I mean, this is more illustrative of some thinking that is reflected in reform, or not. I mean, do we have one of these in every state? Do we have two of them? I mean, how many schools are doing something like this?
So I think it's there's two parts to this. So there are about 15 or 20 high schools with these very formalized Homeland Security programs. So programs that have official Homeland Security classes, electives, internships, guest speakers, and things like that. So that's, you know, in D.C., Maryland, Virginia, New York, Pennsylvania, California, Georgia. So there are a number of states who have adopted these kinds of programs. And so, yes, on the one hand, it's a small number of schools compared to, you know, the number of schools nationwide. But I also think it's indicative of a deepening relationship between the national security state and public schools. And so part of what my research is trying to show is that you have formalized Homeland Security programs, but you also have science and engineering programs that are funded by defense contractors. You have NSA spy camps for kids. So it's not just formalized Homeland Security programs. You're seeing this intensification of national security in U.S. public schools in a variety of different formations. One happens to be these Homeland Security programs.
So this program, as being so explicit, is on a spectrum of a phenomena that is happening. Is it growing? Is there a rate of increase of this happening, This obviously is a function of 9/11, 2001, and the subsequent development. I mean, I had never heard the word homeland, at least in the context of the United States before. I mean, maybe in some movies about World War II from the German perspective. But I had never heard the word homeland used in our country before. I mean, so are we what's the trend, I guess, at this point?
So this is not something that's going away. There's an uptick in Homeland Security schools. There are new schools year after year who are adopting these programs. And so these programs are here to stay. I think as our shifting understanding of national security, as our understanding of national security shifts, I think we're going to see shifts in the relationship between national security and public schools. So we're also seeing an intensification of teachers who are deputized to identify students who might be quote-unquote domestic terrorists or lone wolf terrorists. You have curriculum being inserted to sort of off-ramp young people from the pathway of violent extremism. So our focus on the global war on terror and our commitment to the global war on terror continues to be amplified daily in different formations, we're seeing different articulations of that within U.S. public schools. So you might not see, you know, over a 5 or 10 year outlook, a major growth in Homeland Security programs, but I think you'll continue to see a growth in some kind of relationship between national security and U.S. public schools. I think it'll continue to morph and change as our understanding and tactics around the global war on terror continue to change.
All right, I want to get to some of the history you provide of this integration of the defense industry with public schools, and sort of you break it down into sort of like military and national security. But will you, I mean, I just so that people have a sense of this, you know, going forward as we talk about this more, so that people get a sense of like what this actually means, because it's still such a weird, it's just a weird thing to think about. That you have a school that is just geared towards, I'm trying to draw an analogy so people can understand it, but it's almost like it's like a like the vocational school on some level, but the vocation just happens to be spycraft. Today we're going to the assembly to hear about a hacker who used to work for the NSA, or somebody who's going to tell us how to, I mean, some of the stuff about where you have students who, and I think even like in the beginning of the book, you talk about entering into the high school, and there's a notion that the student who lets you in sort of scans the campus as they open the locked door for you, as if they're looking for someone encroaching on the school. I mean, we just give us a sense of like, what's a day like for these students?
Yes, I think your analogy to the vocational program is accurate. It's sort of like, you know, going to some kind of mechanics vocational program, except now the vocation is Homeland Security. And you're also right that this Homeland Security theme really infused the school. So, you know, a day in the life of somebody in a Homeland Security program is you might be attending a formalized Homeland Security class. So these are classes that teach young people about the certain national security threats, about the latest terror threat facing the United States, as well as these very militarized emergency management responses and procedures the United States deploys in order to protect the nation. So if cybersecurity is seen as a pressing national security threat, students learn about that threat, and then they're also practicing or learning about strategies to defuse that threat. So it is like a vocational program, but it's also about shaping how young people are thinking about national security, how people are defining what counts as national security, and then how to ensure that national security. So national security here is squarely defined as terrorism, as outside intruders committing acts of violence on U.S. citizens. And the means of security there is militarized responses. It's not thinking about security or insecurity in terms of things like gentrification or poverty, the very things that do make young people very insecure on a day-to-day level. So it was really about a study of national security, but then also the infusion of sort of sentiments, beliefs, and logics that make young people buy into this curriculum. So the glorification of violence, a deep sense of patriotism, and that the ultimate expression of patriotism, you know, is military enlistment. So it's about sort of the curricular, the factual study of national security that certainly has an ideological bent, but it's also about infusing a sense of fear in young people, a national responsibility to contribute to war, and things like that.
Is there an active attempt to create a certain level of paranoia, or is that a certain inevitability? I mean, I know, like, just, you know, because I'm immersed in politics so much that my worldview is so myopic in terms of, like, you know, the gravity of political things that happen. I mean, if you're going to school every day, and today is what, you know, this is how vulnerable our grid is to a terrorist attack. Tomorrow we talk about how vulnerable our food supply is to a terrorist attack. The next day we talk about all the soft targets that are around you. At one point you start to, that becomes, you lose perspective just by osmosis. Is that the problem, or is there even a little bit more of like a little bit of a shove? Because I mean, I can't help but think that, like, the equivalent in terms of what I find problematic about this is there are universities that pump out theocrats to go into government and to impose sort of a theocratic worldview as they hold positions in government. Now, this is obviously diminished to a certain extent because we don't have an administration and executive branch right now that is partial to that, but certainly during the Bush administration it was. But it seems like regardless of who's in power in the executive branch of our government now, there's this very pro-national security, or this type of national security perspective. I mean, so they're shaping the whole human being, it seems to me, to become sort of a cog in this machine.
Yes. And for me, I think teachers would not interpret their work in that sense. But I agree with you that it's sort of an inevitability. If you're studying how your water, agriculture, telephone, internet, grocery store, bus could be the site of a terrorist attack any minute. Fear becomes an inevitable consequence. I don't think it's, I don't want to draw some kind of causal analysis. I think it's more complex than that. I think if, even if fear wasn't an explicit intention of teachers, you can't teach these topics without building a sense of fear. So throughout the school day, guest speakers would always make reference to things like September 11th. And September 11th became sort of this way of infusing a very palpable sense of grief and fear and mourning in students, whether that was intentional or not, but it always became this grief-stricken reference point to then justify these militarized measures in order to prevent what they were saying, we have to prevent another September 11th. And so that really became an emotional or effective anchor for the program. And so it was about grief, it was about fear. And even if teachers were saying, well, I'm not promoting fear, I'm not promoting grief, or I'm not promoting violence, these are very much infused into the curricular decisions and really culture that was cultivated at Milton.
I mean, the existence of it in and of itself, right? I mean, is an implication of like, this is, if we're going to set up a whole program here, then this is a threat that is significant enough that we need to train people at age, I guess, 13 or 14 on, right? I mean, like just even the existence of the program, it seems to me, it implies a certain amount of like, we are insecure.
Yes. And I think that's, it's important to identify that because I would think teachers and administrators would say that this program is doing good for the students, it's doing good for the country, it's doing good for the community. And that understanding, so it's how these good intentions are then arched through national security that I think is really important to understand that it's not good teachers who are doing bad things. It's how did we arrive here as a nation where we think that public school reform has to take on this national security lens, or that that the purpose of education is to train young people for national security jobs, or to instill the sense of fear, or these ideological underpinnings that make fear and violence possible.
How did Milton come to this? I mean, give me a sense of what was happening at Milton before this program was instituted, and where was the impetus? I mean, did all these programs around the country that you mentioned, did they all start essentially at the same time? Was this a push or a pull situation in terms of adopting this?
So there are a number of different things going on at Milton. So before the Homeland Security Program began, Milton was considered a struggling school. It had sort of a notorious reputation in the community as underperforming, as rife with violence. This corresponded to a shift in demographics. The school used to serve a white working class population, and it shifted in the early 2000s to a more poor and working class student of color student body. And the school didn't really know how to meet the needs of this new student body, the demographics of this new student body. And so the school engaged in a number of school reform efforts over time, and a lot of that was anchored in training young people for jobs. So that was always a key part of the school trying to improve itself, that we can get students engaged by organizing school curriculum around future jobs. And the school had undergone a number of school reform projects that didn't work or weren't continued to be funded for a variety of different reasons. And it was around that time a defense contractor approached Milton High School and said, look, we're really interested in developing some kind of magnet program or STEM program or homeland security program. And so that was how the conversation started. And the entire district actually created a model where each of their high schools would go out and meet with community members to decide on a theme for their school. So there are schools with an engineering theme, schools with a global citizenship theme. Milton chose the homeland security theme. And the idea of that was you can leverage the resources of business leaders in the community in order to support a school reform project. And you could organize an entire program around the expertise of business leaders. And so Milton went out and specifically consulted with Homeland Security experts. And so again, this was in a context of a struggling school. It was seen as a way to improve graduation rates, improve the economic status of young people so they would have jobs after graduation. And it was also a way of engaging young people in the classroom through this thrilling curriculum It would make education what they called relevant and rigorous to young people.
Has it worked? I mean, in terms of those being the goals, are we seeing higher retention rates, higher graduation rates? Is there any tracking done of these students after they graduate, et cetera?
So there hasn't been extensive tracking done by the school. This was something that they admitted was a flaw of the program. When the first cohort graduated a couple of years ago, one of the teachers was boasting that all of her students graduated and either went into the military or went into college. She never disaggregated, and the school has never disaggregated the percentage of students going to the military and the percentage of going to college. But, you know, from my own experience there, I can say that young people were engaged. They were enthusiastic. They were participating. And so from my perspective, the school was doing all of those things. Of course, it was doing all of those things and then also instilling fear and a sense of military duty in young people. But that you can't really contest that the program was improving student engagement at the school.
So, I mean, the program's successful on its own terms, both the terms of that are the fundamental assumption about the insecurity that we face as a nation, and also in terms of its what it perceives its educational mission and goals to be. It's been successful.
Yes, it's by all accounts, it's a successful program. And so this is part of actually why the school invited me down. This is why they welcomed me into the school, because they were proud of the work that they had done, because they were showing our students are engaged. Our students are graduating from high school. How could you possibly critique what we're doing here? This is doing very good things for our young people.
I want to get to that part of it because the critique it seems to be ultimately one that is almost untethered from the school in some fashion. But I just want to note the irony here, and you would have a better sense of this if I'm correct on this. The change in demographics, I imagine, is directly tied into the rise of the national security apparatus in this country, insofar as those counties around there are the wealthiest growing counties, right? Because of the defense industry. And so it's driving poverty out deeper into the suburbs or further out into the suburbs, because all the money around Washington, D.C., as a direct function of these national security stuff, drives the kids out there, changes the tenor of the school, and then looks to the national security state in some way to rescue the school.
Yes, and so these are young people who are pushed out of city centers. You know, there are public housing units in the suburbs that this school is located in. And so we have to really think about how did we come to a moment in time where there's public housing in suburbs rather than in city centers. And so then, there's this turn to the national security industry, but it's the national security industry that's making young people economically insecure because there's no economic opportunities for them. And the way that gentrification works, it makes young people even more insecure. And so, yes, there's an irony, there's sort of a contradiction there, that what is actually making young people secure or insecure and what will make young people secure. And the national security industry is both the cause of their insecurity, but also sought out as their form of security. And this contradiction comes into play, for example, when young people say, well, we feel really unsafe in our school, in our community, so we need more surveillance, police, armed guards, and things like that. And the school would say, well, our students are what makes us unsafe. So yes, we'll get more security cameras, armed police officers, and guards who will then survey students. And so students are calling for security, and then the school is deploying those security measures on students. And so, again, it's this contradiction where you get young people to buy into the very practices that harm them or make them insecure.
Do these programs, I mean, specifically this one, and broadly, do they deal with the actual security of the school too? I mean, do they say, like, you know, we're talking about these broader issues of the country, but here we're going to apply them directly to our campus, let's say. So in the same way that we need to protect our our infrastructure, our borders from infiltration of terrorists. Johnny and Mary, you guys are going to be the border guards, and you're actually, we're going to post you every day for an hour during study hall. You're going to be posted and look for shooters or whatever it is.
So they're not, they don't enact national security in that way, but they're certainly learning about national security threats to the school. So students, when I ask students, do you feel safe in school? They provided a very technical reading of this school. They can identify, you know, there are these doors that are unlocked or these classrooms don't have doors. So they can identify what they consider to be national security risks within the school as well as their own community. So they were saying things like riding the bus. They now saw riding public transportation as potentially dangerous, and they would have to take measures on the bus to protect themselves. And so I think there's this interplay between, a lot of times we talk about national security threats sort of in this abstract, international, global sort of way, but young people were then interpreting that and making sense of those national security threats in a very sort of everyday way. So how are they made insecure walking to the bus, riding the bus, in school, talking to strangers, using the internet, shopping in their grocery store. And this is what makes fear palpable and recognizable. If you just have some abstract national security threat, it doesn't really affect us. We don't really feel a deep sense of fear. But if you then translate it to every day I go to a building where there could be a mass murder, or I can be assaulted on public transportation, that's how fear sort of is made relevant and understandable to young people's everyday lives. And those were the deep fears that young people were articulating. It was the fear of a terrorist threat in their community, their school, or in their homes.
And so did you get a sense, I mean, did you talk to any of the graduates? Like, I'm curious as to how people react. I imagine there are people, and I guess the question exists too for the students that you were around. I imagine there are some students that are really engaged. I mean, as a high school kid, I can imagine just myself being like, "Oh, this is super cool," and getting into it, frankly. But I could also imagine that there are some kids who are going like, "This is really creepy, and I don't like it, and I need to be on Xanax because I'm hyper conscious of every potential threat that lurks around every corner."
So most of the students were deeply engaged, and most of the teachers supported the program. I actually never met anyone, graduates, teachers, parents, students, who opposed the program on ideological grounds. I never heard someone say national security in public schools, that's problematic, that's concerning. A lot of it was, young people said like, "Well, I'm going to be a football player, so I don't need this class," or, "Well, I was put in this class just because, it fit my schedule." So that was the resistance I heard from young people. From teachers, the main resistance I heard was, "Oh, this is another school reform project. It's not going to last. Why should we rewrite our curriculum to fit national security? In 2 years, there's going to be something else." So there was some marginal resistance to the program, but I never heard someone say, "We shouldn't have this program because of these outcomes." I will say that a couple of teachers said, "Oh, well, I would never have my own children participate in the program because I wouldn't want them to be afraid, and I wouldn't want them to be exposed to violence." And it was sort of a small opening into questioning the program. But then teachers would say, "Well, for these kids, this program is good for these kids. And so what was good for their children, what wasn't good for their children, is seen as good for these students." And that was the main resistance I saw. The principal did sort of reflect on thinking about his own experiences in the Cold War, doing things like duck and cover, and thinking about the cultivation of fear in him. And I remember him saying something like, it was silly what we were doing, and trying to think about, well, if we're cultivating fear in young people, how do we counterbalance that? But there was never any wholesale dismissal of maybe we're doing something that's really problematic that we should consider getting rid of. It was, maybe there are these problematic things that are happening, but we can sort of balance them out with something else.
Can we just spend a little time on the concept of, for these kids, it's good? I mean, because that there's a, I mean, this is, that is, there's a quality to that that you see throughout a lot of the sort of the corporate reform movement that we've seen across the country. I mean, immediately when I hear that dynamic, it reminds me of the Chicago teachers strike and the idea that I distinctly remember maybe it was Karen Lewis, who's the head of the teachers union at the time, or other people who were saying, you know, Penny Pritzker, who at that time was, I think she might have been on the school committee or whatever it was in Chicago. She's now the commerce secretary. And Rahm Emanuel, their kids go to schools with all this touchy-feely stuff that they say our kids shouldn't have and stand in the way of them getting, you know, a job. So, I mean, can you talk about that concept of there is there's definitely a quality when it comes to this corporate reform that kids from living in poverty or from lower income homes, they really wouldn't know what to do with, or it's almost irresponsible to teach them to provide a curriculum to them that is in any way, I don't know, soft, involving like things like art or you know, literature or something that isn't quite vocational.
Yeah, so there's certainly a racialized class component to this. This particular iteration of the Homeland Security Program was only possible because it's a poor and working class student body that is also of color. And with it, it comes assumptions about what young people need. So as you mentioned, young people need discipline. They need, vocational practice for them to be engaged in school. They don't need to be focused on things like critical thinking skills or learning to read and write the world. It's very much a sort of narrow kind of curriculum. And, you know, the way that organizes Homeland Security at Milton meant it had a very explicit military focus. And one of the teachers at the school said, look, our program has a military focus because blue-collar kids get blue-collar jobs. I would say it's also kids of color get jobs that are set aside for kids of color, right? There's this sort of cycling of young people of color through specific jobs. And then he said, look, there's a school just down the road from us in this affluent, whiter, wealthier part of the county, and they're going to install a Homeland Security Studies program, but it's going to have an engineering focus. And it was said to me as though no explanation was needed. It was clear that for Milton students, a military-focused program made sense, and for these more affluent, whiter students, an engineering-focused program just made sense. There was no need to have a conversation about it because all the explaining was already done. And so, and you see this across history, the rise of GROTC programs was about disciplining young people of color and immigrants from its inception in 1916 and the various iterations of military programming in the United States. So there is this certain understanding that young people of color, especially poor and working class youth of color, need this discipline-focused kind of education that sort of doesn't allow for critical thinking, doesn't allow for critical inquiry, and doesn't really allow for any kind of movement beyond sort of this more rigid curriculum and culture.
This may be a silly question. I mean, it's clear you were fascinated by this and you entered. But what do you hope happens with the work that you have done, and who do you anticipate will use that work in whatever that agenda is?
So for me, I really want to have a really national dialogue about the current context and the current situation regarding Homeland Security in U.S. public schools. I think the fact that most of us in the United States have no idea that these institutional arrangements are going on really tells us something about how Homeland Security has been able to quietly infiltrate U.S. public schools. So I really think it's important that we as a nation have a dialogue not only about are these good or bad. I think that is not the kind of discussion I'm interested in. It's more about how did we come to a moment in time where a national security education is seen as the solution to pressing social problems, where we value training young people for war, where we celebrate the study of terrorism and particular responses to terrorism, So to really have a public debate about this intersection between national security and public schools, for me, is one of the hopes of the books, where teachers who are very well-intentioned and want to improve the educational opportunities for young people think about the kinds of curricula and culture they're instilling in their schools and what the effects are, what drives their understandings of what counts as good public school reform or good education, particularly for youth of color. So for me, my hope is that there's some kind of national dialogue around this that really draws the perspectives of teachers and students to the fore.
Nicole Wynn, A Curriculum of Fear, Homeland Security in U.S. Public Schools. We'll put a link to that book on our homepage. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks so much.
All right, folks. Just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Apparently, Michael was a little mean the other day, lost a couple of people. Yes.
What did I do?
Well, you talked about Jill Stein in a mean way.
Oh, my mistake.
So.
She's really like the second coming of, I don't know, Gandhi.
Well, don't make it worse, Michael.
No, I'm being sincere.
So if you're someone who can handle
what I said.
Michael's sassiness when it comes to Jill Stein, by all means, become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. If Michael, maybe you were a little bit less sassy, maybe you should be doing a little better today.
Oh, yeah.
Also,
I'll go
folks,
low energy on Jill.
Justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. If you buy crap from Amazon and or Jet, it's still a good company, at least for the time being. I'm sure it'll always be. I don't know what the arrangement. I have no idea what the arrangements are. I only know what I read. If you buy stuff from Jet.com, and at the very least, you know, it's better than having a monopoly in my perspective. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, bookmark that link, either the Jet link or the Amazon link. Buy your Amazon or your Jet stuff through that. We get a kickback. So you'll notice no difference whatsoever, but we get a kickback. That's like the best case scenario for people who don't even want to become a member. But I don't know why you wouldn't want to become a member. Also, don't forget, this show is powered by fans.fm. If you want to start a podcast and you want to do it very easily, go to fans.fm. Why is that so upsetting to Kelly? Just want us to have competition. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.